Most people are here. Is anyone who's not here? Please put your hand up. So, welcome to this morning's talk. Hopefully you're starting to settle into the place, which means you can give some more detailed talks about how to meditate and what to do, or rather, what not to do. Because a lot of meditation is natural, and so we have to try and make sure that you know what not to do. But in order to understand the path of meditation, just to understand how it works and what's actually happening, is because of stillness, that is why things disappear. The brain is only wired to notice things which change. So, it's one of the reasons why when I keep telling the same old stories, the brain turns off. You only notice things which change. New stuff, different stuff, and that's just with all of the senses. And the classic story was years ago when I went to, as a still a student, and you go to any retreat you could possibly get to. I didn't care where it was, what tradition, because it was just so hard to find a meditation retreat in the UK in 1972 or whatever. So I found a Zen monastery up in Northumberland and just signed up for the weekend. But I'd never done Zen meditation before. And first of all, it was scary because you'd be sitting there early in the morning and, you know, there was no sleeping in, you had to go there. And you'd be facing a wall and the Zen master would come behind you with the Zen stick. And if you were nodding, even slightly, whack, on your back. Wow, that was scary. But throughout my whole life, I'd always had very good karma. I never got hit with that stick. And the reason was, the guy sitting next to me, he was nodding more than I was. So he got hit first. And as soon as I heard that, I was rigid straight. I was not going to risk getting that. But of course, you know, that was, you know, just old school. And of course, you can't do that anymore, especially in places like Europe or Australia, or even a story from China. When I was in Hong Kong, just, you know, what monks do, you know, we go overseas, we talk to one another, get the latest gossip. You know, because monks do travel around all sorts of places. So I get my spies, my network, to find out what's going on in this place, what's going on in that place. So I got all my sort of spies. And this guy came, he came from mainland China, and he said that on one of those retreats, it was like a Zen retreat, and the master sort of was walking around, and there was this middle-aged Chinese meditator. And so he whacked her on the back with his Zen stick. You know what she did? She got out her mobile phone, and she called the police. It's assault. And the police had no choice. They came to the temple and they arrested the teacher. That was the end of that retreat. They took him away. I don't know what happened afterwards. It was a warning. You can't do that sort of stuff anymore. So anyway, we don't need to do that. The most important part of that, though, was, you know, it's always good, you know, doing new things, different things, because you learn a lot from all those different traditions. What I learned there, you know, it was always number one, sit next to someone who's more sleeper than you are. That was the first thing I learned. And the second thing I learned was just, you were sitting there just watching a whitewashed wall. It was like a converted barn. So you're looking there, looking at this wall, and just no instructions. Thank goodness there was no instructions, because I didn't know what to do, what to expect. So what happened was that, looking at that whitewashed wall, I'd done enough meditation to know how to come into the present moment and stop thinking and fantasizing, just to be. And then the wall, it vanished. It disappeared, which was really weird. Now, I know many of you, as soon as something slightly weird happens, you come and see me, put your name down for me. Something's happening. Look, weird stuff is nice. You're totally safe in this place. So the whole war vanished. That was really cool. You know, because that was the 60s, 70s, I thought, wow, this is really nice. What's going on? And it just, the war wasn't there anymore. Not darkness, not blackness, but nothing. And it didn't take long to reflect. You know, once you've got some data, some strange experiences to work your insight on, it's just the nature of the senses. That because the wall was not moving, nothing was happening, just the sense of sight just turned off, like the, you know, the brain turned off. It's so similar to these days. You're using the computer and you don't click anything. What happens to the screen? It turns off. Now it's only activates when you do something. And the same with your senses, are exactly the same. And you know, I should have known this, but every time when I meditated, I closed my eyes. And the first thing I noticed when I closed my eyes is the inside of my eyelids. But you know, I've got so used to that, I don't really, you know, pay attention to it. But if you close your eyes, what are you seeing inside of your eyelids? The sense of sight hasn't turned off yet. But it's such a sort of uninteresting sort of image. But after a few seconds, you don't know when, it turns off. So you're not seeing anymore. The sense of sight clicked off. So that's one of the reasons why we do close our eyes when we meditate, because it's much easier to turn that sense of sight off. Smell, so easy to turn sense of smell off. In the old days, in all the Buddhist meditation centers, they used to use incense. You know why they have incense there? Because people's personal hygiene was not really that great in the old days. So in order to actually have a constant smell which never sort of changed, or, you know, my silly jokes, that sometimes people do have indigestion, that's just what happens. So the people who pass wind, we always ask them to sit in the very back. If you sit in the front, there's many people behind you have to suffer. But on the back, there's no one has to suffer. So now you know why all the people sitting in the back are sitting there. Of course, that's not true. But the whole point is that the smells don't change. So in other words, that the sense of smell turns off. But you know, just this is the by, by the way. You know that sometimes when people are meditating, they haven't smelled anything for, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 minutes. And then suddenly, well not suddenly, but just they notice like really fragrant smells sometimes. It's been so often that people, oh, what's happened, Ajahn? I was sitting there and just, I smelt this beautiful, like a sandalwood smell, or sort of a lotus smell, something very, very fragrant. I said, what's going on? They said, is it heavenly being? Is it a heavenly being just come to praise my deep meditation? Unfortunately, no. All it is that sometimes it's the mind, actually, when the mind gets very powerful, it creates its own sort of five senses. And it's much more beautiful than the five senses you see with the ordinary stuff. But I'll come into that later on. But the sense of smell turns off. And the taste, it's so easy for the taste to turn off. That's why we don't chew mints or something while we're meditating. Just let the saliva just it's normal, it's natural. After a while, you don't even notice this taste anymore. So that's another sense turned off. And the two hard, difficult senses to turn off are sound and bodily feeling, bodily sensation. Those are the two difficult ones. That is one of the reasons to turn off the sound. We try and keep it nice and quiet in this room. That's why, you know, I ask you, if you please can come in gently, quietly, and leave gently. I know that many times people say, if you do bring any bags in here, not plastic ones, because they really make a lot of noise. You're trying to take something out, that's fine, but it always makes noise. The cloth bags are both much better for the environment, and also just they're quieter. So we try and be quiet as possibly can. of course you cannot extinguish all noise, you know, because as human beings. Fortunately, this place is not on a flight path. It's not next to a busy road. And so, and the animals in the Australian forest are very quiet. And you go into like a Southeast Asian or South Asian forest, you've got all the cicadas at night. And some are so noisy, so loud in the forests, you know, in places like Thailand or Malaysia. Here it's just so calm at night time. And so this is one of the reasons why it's a very peaceful place, and just that amount of peace. You know, not too much. Yeah, of course, you hear the birds every now and again, but it's not much noise. So it's an important part of this retreat center. You know, it's ambience of quiet. So please don't disturb that by talking. Okay, first day we'll give you a bit of a break, but please. And if you see any visitors or these kind people who are bringing you food, you know, they're not on retreat, they can talk, but don't talk back to them. And if there's anyone here who you think really is talking a lot, then we always have in the back room over there the masking tape. We put it over their mouth, leave a little hole with a straw in so they can still drink. Haven't used that yet. Never will, obviously. But just try and be calm and quiet. So when it's quiet, the sense of sound can turn off. That is one of the problems with what you were asking me last night about the sound of silence. If you use that, use it at the very beginning, but don't go too far with it, because it's still, you know, you've got this sense of sound. You're not really turning it off yet, which means you can't go deeper into the meditation. You can go so far, but you come across a brick wall, you can't go further. So even just the sound, it's best to let go of all sound. One of the hardest things to let go of is, again, your physical feelings. Those two are the most difficult. But the physical feeling in the body, that takes up the major parts of our meditation practice, which is why, you know, in order to keep the body still so there's no aches, pains, nothing throbbing, so your body can vanish and disappear, that is a difficult part. And it's because of that, and that number one, you know, we make this a comfortable place for your body. You've got nice beds you can rest upon. So, you know, wake up in the morning, you're not sort of aches and pains. You have a good night's sleep, I hope. If you haven't had a good night's sleep, you can catch up during this talk. It's recorded. It's recorded, so you can learn it later on. No. But there's many other opportunities where you can catch up on sleep. If for some reason you don't sleep very well. So that your body feels well fed, well watered, you know, you've got nice toilets for yourself so you don't have to wait for other people, so your body is comfortable. And this hall, we try our very best to make it comfortable for you. You've got your cushions. If there's not enough cushions, you get some, there's so many cushions around this place, so you can get something from your room, from somewhere else, and just make your body nice and comfortable. I'm sure that the teddy bear, just to make merit, if you want to put that under your bottom just to be able to be nice, I'm sure the teddy bear won't mind. It's very compassionate. Their body's out for bears, so they're ready to sacrifice their own comfort for your enlightenment. So you're trying to make the body nice and comfortable. And because of that, even the very beginning of the meditation, as I was saying yesterday, you're aware of your body. And don't ever think there is a magic posture, position for your body which works all the time. And the only problem why you haven't got enlightened yet is you don't know how to sit in full lotus. If you want to learn how to sit in full lotus, go to yoga classes. But you don't need to actually to force a body. You can sit any old way as long as it's comfortable. And the experience which I had, which proves that for myself. I was always one of these people who looked at the books and thought, oh, you've got to meditate this way. You've got to be full lotus and right hand over the left hand, thumb slightly touching. Not too hard, just that matter. back straight, chin down. That was just play acting. It wasn't natural. And there was this one occasion when I had scrub typhus. The hospital didn't know what it was. This was in the cheap part of a third world hospital in the backwoods of northeast Thailand. And so just the care there was, oh, I don't know, that these days you would never get any star ratings. It was just, it'd be negative. It was really sort of really quite coarse. But people were trying to do the best they can. They were kind. Except I can't resist telling the story of this nurse. This nurse would come in to this monk's ward twice a day because I had a fever and no one knew what it was. The point was that in that part of Thailand, the health department thought there wasn't any scrub typhus at all. And the reason was the locals had immunity. They developed immunity over the generations. And so the Western monks came in. We hadn't any immunity, so we caught this scrub typhus and they didn't know what it was. So they're just a cocktail of antibiotics injected into your backside twice a day. Now, you would think, what's wrong with that? But the needles they have these days are nothing like the needles they had, 40 years ago. Those ones, 40 years ago, they were recycled. These ones, they are, honestly. You know, they used to put them in the little steamers to try and sort of get the bugs off them. And they kept on stabbing you in the backside with these. Now, this was a really poor part of Thailand. In those years, Thailand was third world. Even in Bangkok, unless you went to a private hospital, you were chancing your luck. So I was pretty sure that they'd use the needles in Bangkok first of all, and then they sent them up to the provinces afterwards, to save costs. And after you use them in the main hospitals in the provinces, the last place they used was the monks' hospitals. Or the monks' wards in the hospitals. Because we're supposed to be the tough guys. Can't complain. And that's what happened. So, this nurse. Now, you may have this idea of like petite, pretty nurses in Thai hospitals. Maybe these days. But in those days, she reminded me of a water buffalo. And she had to, because she had to be strong. Not to hold the monks down, but to stab and to puncture the skin. Bang! Oh no, that really hurt. And after about sort of a week or 10 days of that, your butt was so sore. And despite all of my training in loving kindness, adore my heart, not for you. So anyway, but you're really sick. And so having a sore bum and just really, if you had a fever for a few weeks, you just no energy. I mean, really no energy. Now people say, I feel a bit tired today, but at least you can get up. You can't even get up out of the bed. So what happened was feeling just, when you get tired, you get a bit depressed, miserable. How long have I got to endure this? But instead of just wallowing depression, thinking just, when Ajahn Chah came to visit me, great help. He came up to me and said, Ajahn Brahm, he wasn't Ajahn then, just Brahm, Brahma Wangso, you'll either get better or you'll die. The worst part about that, you couldn't argue with him. It was right, it was true. But it's not what I needed at the time. So please, I know that many have heard that story before, but if you go and see your dear old mother in the hospital, please don't do that to her. Mom, nice to see you, darling. You'll either get better or you'll die. Bye-bye. That's one sure way of getting written out of the will. So what I did, what am I supposed to do? I'm a monk. Meditate. So there you were in a fever. Really, absolutely zero energy. So you couldn't get up. You couldn't go and sit in full lotus. That was absolutely impossible. So just, if you see a person in the hospital in a fever, one leg this way, one leg the other way, an arm this way and all over the place, And I just, you know, that was the most comfortable position, so I just left it there and just decided to meditate and just go into this incredibly deep meditation. And just the contrast, you know, between beforehand when your body was worse than usual and just better than ever, it was amazing to be able to do that. To prove that, yeah, it can be done. You can get into the deepest of meditations in the most, I've never ever seen that posture in any meditation book. It was all over the place, but it worked. What it told me is let the body decide what posture it wants. How it wants to put its hands, how it wants to put its legs, how it puts its back. To be able to find out from your body, you just feel it. See, is this the best posture, body, how are you? That's what mindfulness and wisdom does. It's the opposite of just, you know, belief in just what you've been told, in theory, in knowledge. Knowledge just is other people's, what works for them. So don't go and say, oh, I haven't got any deep meditation yet, I'm going to go into bed, I'll maybe get a fever first of all, and then try that posture. Leg over here, leg over there, all over the place. Of course it won't work for you, because it just was the right thing at the right time, you know, when I had a fever in that place many years ago. So this is where you feel the body. You get to know your body. Now, it will always be different, every meditation. And so, okay, I'm going to introduce a word now. You're going to hear this many, many times. It's go, my young. Now, go, many of you are laughing, because go, my young means go is the Pali word for bull, B-U-L-L. And my young is what comes out of the backside of a bull, in the S-H-I-T. I'm not really supposed to say that word, but so I won't say that any word, that word again. Instead, I'll say go, my young. So if you hear me say it's a lot of go, my young, you know what I mean. There's a lot of go, my young, to say, well, you've got to sort of connect your energies together to form a circle. You've got to have a straight back, otherwise the energies can't flow properly. You've got to sort of be full lotus and very, very straight back. All of that is go, my young. And you can prove that for yourself. Your personal experience shows you that sometimes you get into deep meditation in all sorts of postures. And especially sitting on a chair. Because otherwise people think, oh, I can't ever get any good meditation because I can't sit on the floor. I've had a motorbike accident. I've, you know, had sort of other accidents, sports accidents, whatever accidents. I can't do that. And that cuts off meditation for a large proportion of the population. Oh, I'm too old. That also cuts it off. Oh, I'm sick. I can't meditate. That is so much go, my young. If you can sit, lay down, you know, find some posture where you're reasonably comfortable, then of course you can meditate. So that's the first thing. You sit comfortably so much of the body can disappear. You know, this, I'm sitting comfortably here, my butt is okay, after a while I won't feel it anymore. My legs, they're pretty comfortable, so I can't feel them soon. Back is really nice, it's not a big ache or a pain anywhere. It disappears, no headache, no sort of ache anywhere in the body, I look after those. So it's so easy to let the body disappear, and it's not keep on, you know, bothering you with an ache here, a pain there, or an itch or something. So just look after your body. That was the whole point of the Buddha's middle way, you know, to make sure your body's comfortable enough to be able to let it go, let it disappear. So you're sitting here, and what I was saying yesterday about just, you know, feeling the body, making it nice and comfortable during the meditation, if you get an ache or a pain, if it's the sort of ache or pain, if you ignore it, it'll get worse and just keep on bothering you. If that's the case, then just move. It takes about 10 seconds to move my leg. Yeah, I've disturbed the meditation, I've gone backwards, but I soon get back to where I left off when I began moving. Now I can go very much deeper. It's worth it to move. Instead of just, I mustn't move. And it gets much worse, more tense. So just move. you need to cough during the meditation, finish, done with, and then you can carry on meditating. Instead of always thinking, I mustn't cough, I mustn't sort of move, I mustn't scratch. Those are the things which stop you getting into deep meditation. So after a while, the body really relaxes and starts to disappear. Now, I did tell you then to go onto a piezometer, which is just in order for you to have enough stillness, peace, so your mindfulness gets to appropriate level of strength. Mindfulness is important, but it has to be strong and reasonably still for you to be able to watch something, just say, even like the breath. Now, how many times people, they start watching the breath. Breathing in, breathing out, in, out, in, out. I wonder what's for dinner this evening. Or this afternoon. There's no dinner this afternoon. What's for lunch? I wonder what Bianca's cooking. I went past it today and something smelled really nice. I wonder what it is. I hope it's lasagna, because Bianca cooks this amazing sort of vegetarian lasagna. But oh no, maybe somebody else is coming today. You know, you're supposed to be watching the breath instead of thinking about food. So why is that the case? Why is it that people can't just do something just like watch the breath for half an hour? Because you haven't done enough preparation yet. If any of you looks at Anapanasati Sutta, first of all, remember it's Anapanasati. It's not Anapanasati. Answering that question the last night, I was supposed to have said that through pain you can actually get enlightenment or something. I don't know, absolutely I can't remember saying that, but absolutely I don't agree with that at all. We don't do Anapanasati. Sati is mindfulness, Ana means along with, Anapanasati, mindfulness is along with the breath. We don't do mindfulness along with pain. Okay? So, as we have a comfortable body, and we relax our mind. When the mind is relaxed, we've got enough peace, then the mindfulness becomes quite strong. This is something which you'll find, and I will teach many times during this meditation retreat. You'll find when you start, you're tired, you're dull. Why? Because you've been traveling a lot, doing a lot. And it takes a while for you to actually wake up, to get your energies up. And this is just the nature of just not doing very much, being still, resting, not expending your energies, thinking or talking or worrying. When you preserve your energies, they start to build. And your mindfulness starts to get quite strong. You find you can just sit out in front of the kitchen with a cup of tea for an hour, quite happily. You don't need to check your text messages. You don't need to actually to read a book. You don't need to take notes. You start to develop a peaceful mind which doesn't need to have external stimulation to satisfy it. And the trees you start to notice so much more in the landscape. The trees become more beautiful, the sky becomes incredible, your mindfulness becomes so strong, you can start to appreciate the beauty of what you see, even the sound of the birds, beautiful, and even better, the wind passing by your face. You become very alert, and naturally alert, and that natural alertness always gives you a lot of satisfaction. It's delightful. So that is the degree of mindfulness we need, first of all. That's why you relax the body, then get some peace in the mind until the mind really starts to wake up. Then it becomes so easy to watch your breathing. You can sit there just watching the breath go in, go out. Why are you watching the breath? It is because there's two reasons for that. One is a very pleasant thing to watch. I often sort of ask myself, why is it so nice to watch the breathing? It's a very comfortable rhythm. And my theory is that it's one of those rhythms which you recognize from the earliest times of your existence in this life. When you were the fetus in your mother's womb, can you imagine the rhythm which you got accustomed to was the rise and fall of your mother's abdomen? Or when you were breastfeeding, again, on her tummy, up and down according to the rhythm of her breathing. It's very deeply embedded in us as a comfortable, safe, warm rhythm of our breathing. So first of all, it's attractive, and I think that's the reason why. But also, it is basically the last thing which is moving. Everything else is still. So the arms have disappeared, feet have disappeared, and don't be worried when they disappear. I mention this because years ago, at one of the retreats, it was a person who just started meditating. They came up to me during an interview, very concerned. They said, "Well, what's going on? My hands disappeared." That's all. After so many days, that's they're supposed to disappear. That's if you get the rest of your arms and legs to disappear. They thought it was really weird. They couldn't feel their hands. That's what's supposed to happen. You don't feel your hands, your arms, your back, your head, your legs. Everything vanishes. When all that vanishes, the last thing which is moving is... Now, a bit of a word of warning that sometimes there's something else which is moving, and that's your heartbeat. But, you know, please don't focus on your heartbeat, because the whole idea, you've got to calm it down for it to disappear. And if you calm down your heartbeat, then it stops, you're in big trouble. And so am I. And Paul will be anchored too, because he has to go and call the ambulance. So, don't worry about the heart, that just does its own thing. Just keep just focusing, just very gently. It happens by itself, on the breath, breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out. If you do this properly, just, you know, making the mind peaceful first of all, it's called establishing mindfulness as a priority. Again, part of the first stages of Anapanasati. Where it says in the Anapanasati Sutta, establish mindfulness in front of you. If you have a look at that, say, that doesn't make any sense. What do you mean, in front of who? I'm not supposed to be here. I'm supposed to be anatta. In front of what? Does that mean because hundreds of years ago people actually thought their consciousness was in their chest, so we established mindfulness here? But now, because Westerners were so much up in our head, it's up here. So, which one are we supposed to do? It doesn't mean in front of you. It means as a priority, the first spot, the number one thing to do in your list. Prioritizing mindfulness. So, you don't go and watch the breath yet. You make mindfulness established first of all. And as your mindfulness becomes established, you are aware, not through force, but naturally. You know, you're not so busy, you're not so distracted. Basically, to be mindful, you have to be in the present moment, not thinking. If you're thinking, well, you're thinking of something in the past, future, something, you know, which is not really happening right now. So the thinking just is being mindful of the here and now. And obviously, thinking what happened in the past, what am I going to do next, that's not being mindful either. So basic mindfulness, present moment awareness, silence, not forcing it, natural. You're just here. It becomes so easy to watch the breath. The reason is because the breath is basically the only thing moving. And here we get to an important part of meditation, is that so much of meditation you don't choose. It just happens. You just stop doing things. So when I meditate, honestly, I never ever choose to watch my breathing. I just let go, sit down, relax the body, relax the mind, and then the breath comes up by itself. I don't go looking for it. It comes to me. And it's much more pleasant. If you go looking for the breath, when you first get it, it's a bit unpleasant. If you just let go, relax, when it comes to you, it's always very, very nice. So, what we're doing here, sitting down, relax in the body, so it disappears. Going to the peaceometer, relaxing the mind. And many people say, well, what am I supposed to watch? There's no supposed. The question is, what are you watching? What are you observing right now? What is it? You're observing something. You know you're aware of something. What is it? So we don't choose. We just know what's happening right now. And then you do keep on doing this. You know, you look at the peaceometer, how peaceful your mind is, how peaceful your body is. And then you'll find you're aware of your breathing. It's just there. And later on, when the breathing gets very refined and starts to disappear, like someone said last night, what do I watch? Whatever's left. That's what you watch. Whatever it is. Like when you go out from a lit room into the darkness of the night. What happens? You can't see anything at first because your eyes have to adjust to the less intense light of the darkness. But you just wait for a little while as your pupils of your eyes dilate, allowing more light in, and then you can start to see. You get your night vision. You can see little dark shapes, silhouettes, but you can see something. So give your senses time to adjust to more sensitive input in your mind. When you can feel the breath and it starts to vanish, what's left afterwards? Don't disturb the process. Your job is just to watch and be still. And why does the breath start to disappear? Here you just, you know, contemplate it, it's obvious. That because you're sitting still, because you're not thinking and worrying, and please understand that thinking, worrying, planning, that uses up a huge amount of energy. But if you're just here in this moment doing nothing, you're hardly using any energy at all. So it means you don't need much fuel, which means you don't need so much oxygen to burn that fuel, to metabolize. You start to calm down. You become energy efficient. Use a lot, that's a big word these days. Energy efficient, sustainable. So you can just sit there for hours, sustaining the energy which you have, not wasting any. So little by little, you breathe in less. Naturally, not because you force it, because you don't need much oxygen. And you're just breathing in and out. Not forcing it, just natural. Less and less oxygen, gets smoother, lighter. And if you get worried, you start thinking you have to use more oxygen again because your brain has turned on. So just calm down. Everything is all right. No fear. Ajahn Brahm is here. I've never had any casualties yet in my meditation retreats. No one has ever died during my meditation retreats. So I'm not going to lose my perfect track record yet. So if anyone feels like dying, please go out of the premises first of all. But it is just nice and peaceful and calm. So, your breath starts to disappear. All that's happening is that the last part of the five senses vanishes. And so see what happens next. Because you've been focusing on the breath, actually it just blocks out a lot of the sounds. You can't hear them because you're focused on something else, which is very delightful. You don't really know when you stop hearing sounds, but this is just what happens. You can't hear anything. And you just can't see, you can't smell, taste. And the last part of the physical touch turns off. The sense of feeling the breath going in and going out, it vanishes. So what's left? What's left is the mind, the sixth sense. And that is usually experienced after a while. It just measures peaceful, still, but after a while, then you see the beautiful lights come up in your mind. At that stage, you know, sometimes if a person is sort of, you know, not so visual, or you know, they've got a very sensitive nose, yeah, that's a time where you can maybe start smelling just beautiful, like sandalwood smell, or I don't know, lotus, or jasmine, or whatever, you know, sort of smells you like. Now, as for me, you know the smell I like? I think, and the monks know this, which is really weird. The two smells which I really, really like are bat poo and tar. The reason I like that smell of bat poo was I was in this cave in the north of Thailand, up in the mountains. I used to go in there all day, just after lunch, and meditate all day in there. So that's nice meditation. There's obviously lots of bats in the cave. And for this day, you know, whenever I smell bat poo, it's that association with some happy times in my cave up in the north of Thailand, meditating. Because that's what it is, association. The reason I like tar is because I spent a lot of my youth playing soccer, you know, in the street or in the park, if I could walk that far. And of course, the Second World War, any metal railings had been taken away, melted down to make bombs. And so there's no metal railings. So instead, they had these wooden railings, which the only way they could keep them from rotting away during the wet, cold weather is to paint them every year with tar. So I remember that smell from my youth, an association with happy times. So that's why those are two smells which I find delightful. Ah, bat poo. Ah. It's all association, that's all it is, what you like, what you don't like. So anyway, if I had a smell limiter, I got very deep meditation, I'd be, oh, that's the most incredible bat poo smell. Other people would have jasmine smells or something. But anyway, just everyone for their own. But, you know, usually you get something, some image or some feeling. It's not through your senses. That bat poo is not, you haven't got a bat in the room that's pooed somewhere. It's not jasmine flowers in this meditation hall. It is just what you experience through your mind door. But most commonly, it's just beautiful lights in the mind. Those are like the nimittas. You're sitting here and just beautiful light in the mind. Now, that's a great segue to, well, here they are. Sometimes people, they get these nimittas, lights in the mind. They say, oh, it can't be a nimitta, not me. I haven't just gone through the beautiful breath, I've just started all this sort of stuff. It can't be me. People have so many doubts about whether what they see in the mind is a real nimitta or not. When we designed this place, I wanted to make these windows as high as possible so that the chances, especially during the middle of the day, you seeing a light, you know, through the windows is nearly zero. But you know, in the morning time, sometimes you can see the sun come up, or maybe in the afternoon. Only for a short period of time, but you're not facing that way. So anyone who's got any doubts, you get some lights in the mind, use these things. Courtesy of Singapore Airlines. Because it's one of the benefits of me travelling around all the place. So you can put these ones over your eyes. And take your glasses off if you wish to. And you know that what you're seeing is not a nimitta. It can't be. It's not a sort of a light. It must be the real thing, the nimitta. So these are iPads. That's what they call them in the US. iPads. They're very cheap. So you can tell people you get the cheapest iPads. They hand them out for free in China Grove, iPads. Not Apple, not Samsung, but Singapore Airlines. SIA iPads. One of our monks just really likes his high-tech stuff. So I remember once, where's Burr? No, she put me up. Burr's gone. Oh, there she is. Bird game one of these, and she told me that these are called iPads in the US. So I went up to him and said, do you want an iPad? She I said, well, we got a spare one. I said, yeah, I've got a spare one. Is it good quality? Yeah, hasn't ever been used. I said, oh, yeah, I'll have one. If anyone wants, I've got heaps of them. So I collect them for you. So that if you ever want to use these during the meditation retreat, please, you know, just come take one. And it means that what's happening is, you know for sure, no doubts at all, your mind gets very peaceful, five senses are turning off, you know they're turned off, and then you see beautiful lights in the mind. That is the sign of you getting very still. And as you get really, really still, the intensity of that light gets even more. All it is because you're letting go. You're not wasting energy thinking, planning, doing stuff. All that energy just can now go into knowing. Two halves of the mind, this old little simile of mine. Two, if you want to know what they are in Pali, it's in the Vijnana and Sankhara, or with the Sankhara also the Vedana and Sanya. So you know, that's for the Pali nerds. Should I call them nerds? The Sutta nerds. No, not really nerds, but you know, people know about the Pali and the Buddhist sutras. So that this is those two parts of the mind, the knowing and the doing, the active part and the passive part of your mind. The active part of the mind, the doer, that gets most of your energy. Especially these days, you have to do so much to survive this world, to get by. Which is one of the reasons why that people actually just get so dull. They're not alive. Because their knower has got very, very little energy. And if you do a really great amount of work, and especially you get negative, which drains your energy so much, your knower gets so dull that you get depressed. Which is one of the lovely ways of understanding from a meditation point of view what depression is. You're just incredibly low energy. And of course, you know, sometimes you come on a retreat, and sometimes when you start off the retreat, you know, just to transition from a high active life to a low activity life, just to make it more energizing. It's one of the reasons why I do tell jokes. Okay, bad jokes, but you know, it's the best I've got. And also, I haven't actually told the Italian joke yet, have I? This came from the last retreat. Those who want to leave the room now, there's a warning. It's a very terrible joke. Some of you have heard it before. But it's the fellow who said that he had a dream. This is the last retreat we did here. He came to see me. He dreamt he was a piece of ravioli in one of the cottages here. And the next night, he dreamt he was a strand of spaghetti. And then when he asked me about it, you know, I got it straight away. I said, oh, you know, you're remembering your past lives. But you know, terrible. This is a Buddhist joke, okay? It's relevant, sort of. But I was... When I was in England just a couple of weeks ago, it's wonderful. Just any of you who have been in England in the tube, the underground trains, no one looks at you. Now they're either reading their paper or they're looking down here. And even before they had these little mobile devices, they would never ever look at you. That was one of the major rules. You don't look at somebody when you're travelling in these carriages in the underground in London. So anyway, I was sat myself down, going somewhere, and this lady sitting next to me said, looked at me and said, are you a Buddhist monk? How do you know? Yes, a real one. Yeah, a real one. I'm not going to a fancy dress party or something. So we started chatting, and I told this story to her. And as I started telling the story, you know, it's obviously a bit weird at first, the guy who dreamt he was a piece of ravioli. And in a corner of my eyes, I could, because, you know, it's only a small carriage and people could hear everything you say. And they were just looking at me, the corner of their eyes, underneath their, over their newspapers. You know, what's this? It's weird. And when I got to the punchline, they had half the carriage laughing. That's a marvellous achievement, to get half a carriage in the underground in London laughing. That's they give a bit of strange looks afterwards. But anyway, at least I made the morning happy. So anyway, where did we go? What did I say this from? Okay, that's right. Getting some energy up so people don't get so depressed. That's also three sadhus. That is not just playing around. There's a purpose to, behind that. Energizing yourself, getting some happiness up, which means that, you know, you don't need to sort of go thinking and worrying so much. You're content, happy. Which means you don't have to struggle so much. Low energy in the mind disappears, you get livened up, you get woken up. So your mindfulness starts to increase. And when your mindfulness increases in its power, you don't need to expend so much energy doing stuff. In fact, you do very little in this place. Everything is served there. So you can just be. Why isn't it people find it hard to be? Because it's really dull and boring. But you'll find, once the mind starts to energize, it's so wonderful. Yeah, that's where you can just, you can taste even a glass of water. This water is incredibly sweet. It's a bit sort of, I think that's probably, that's probably last year's vintage. <It's> just, I'm not a wine taster, but sometimes you can actually taste much more. Little ordinary things which you pass by now actually can, your mindfulness is strong enough to pick up, you know, what's there and to enjoy it and delight in it. What happens is when you start relaxing more, doing less, the mindfulness increases, and so does the delight. The delight in your lunch, snuggling into your bed at night, your pillows snuggle in there, and it feels so delightful. And that's a warm bed. There's the feeling of the warm shower water over your body. Everything starts to really be enhanced. You're waking up. And when your five senses start to disappear and vanish, oh, your mind is beautiful. So when the five senses do disappear, what you see is just usually so easy to notice. And it's beautiful, a beautiful light, delightful. And then you get into the world of the limitless. Happy little meditator. And this is where you start to get great insights later on. People say, well, are you not just indulging yourself? Is pleasure that bad for you? Some are, some aren't. So the Buddha kept on saying in Nirvana Vibhanga Sutta, there's some pleasures which, they just cause you trouble. There's other pleasures, like the pleasures of the mind, inspiration, just the joy at seeing, you know, beautiful people do such incredible generosity. I'm not sure who's coming to offer the food today, but you look at them, it's just so inspiring to see people who, they're not on retreat, they're not being charged any money for this, they're going to come all the way from Perth to feed you. And they put so much effort and energy into the food they're going to serve you today. That's so inspiring. You can only understand feeding monks and nuns, but there's only a few monks and nuns here. This is for you. And so when you see that and you get joy coming up, don't say, oh no, I'm not supposed to enjoy this. You know, it's bad to have fun. That's really crazy stuff. Inspiration, joy, sympathetic joy, and especially the joy of deep meditation. Those are things which the Buddha said indulge in. Get into it. Because that will strengthen your mindfulness even more. And you'll find you can sit meditation here without any problem or difficulty whatsoever. You sit here, you relax, default state, not doing anything. And the mind brightens up, brightens and brightens, all the senses vanish and disappear. And then you can start getting into the world of your mind. Delightful, beautiful, powerful, weird, strange, but very safe. So this is why we meditate. And to finish off this, there's a type of meditation which sort of puts all this together in one, which hopefully many of you have read my first book, The Opening the Door of Your Heart, otherwise called Who Ordered This Truckload of Dung? That was in the United States. What they would do to try and sell a book, but anyway, it worked. It's a very popular title. But in that book I mentioned the one story which is not, you won't find in Buddhist texts. It's the story of the Emperor's Three Questions from Leo Tolstoy. I read it as a student. And very quickly, I'm sure you must know that, the emperor, fed up with organized religion, decided to invent his own religion, just needed the answer to three major questions. When is the most important time? Who is the most important person? What's the most important thing to do? Hopefully you know the answer to those questions. When's the most important time? Not lunchtime. Now's the most important time. Who is the most important person? Ajahn Brahm. It's whoever's in front of you, whoever that happens to be, was the answer. And that was just an amazing answer. Whoever's right in front of you right now is the most important person in the world. And the most important thing to do? To care. Now, even yesterday, did I go over to Bodhinyana for lunch, because lots of people come and see me over there. And there was a doctor over there, and he just came out and said, I just wanted to say thank you for, you know, for telling us that story. It's more important as a doctor to care rather than to cure. Because, you know, he said in the last couple of weeks or months, he's really started to put it into practice. And it just changed his whole life in the hospital. He said yesterday, I mean the day before now, that'd be Friday, he was delivering a baby, and the poor mother almost died because it was hemorrhaging. Lost half her body weight of blood, or half of blood in her body, whatever it was. And, you know, he just, instead of panicking, he just was caring, caring, caring for her. And it worked. He never panicked. That woman survived. So, you know, she's going to be fine, baby's fine. And just the whole team in the hospital were just so impressed that, you know, caring is more important than curing. And you find that, you know, you get a higher cure rate and not so much stress. So he was really sort of rapt about that. So was I, to see how these things actually work in real life. So caring is more important than curing. So those are the Emperor's three questions. What's that got to do with meditation? So you're sitting down here, you've got your eyes closed. When is the most important time? Now. Start thinking about what you're going to do next. Or, this is happening, what should I do next, Ajahn Brahm? There is no next. Now is the only time you have. What's the most important meditation object? Nimittas, the breath. Whatever's right in front of you right now, that is the most important meditation object. So simple. It's there anyway, so give it importance. So you say, my breath is disappearing. What should I watch? Whatever's right in front of you now. And don't just watch it. Give it importance. Don't look at it as a stepping stone for something bigger and greater. No, give it importance. Whatever it is right now. That's actually what I was doing when I was having a fever in hospital. I wasn't watching my breath. That was impossible. But I was just watching this, whatever it was. Giving it sort of 100% importance. What should I do with it? Should I develop it? Care for it. Caring was more important than developing or curing or making it better. Emperor's Three Questions in meditation. Absolutely brilliant. Now's the only time you have. Whatever's in front of you right now, whatever it is, give it importance. And care for it. That's all you need. And the path just happens. Easy. Okay, for those of you who are depressed, really big sadhus. If you're not depressed, big sadhus anyway. Sadhu! 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 Ho, ho, ho. Very good. Why not laugh? Okay. That's why when a person gets enlightened, you know what they call it? Enlightened being? A ha 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 ha. Somebody got it anyway.